Hello, it's Paul Scott here from qualitysmallcaps.co.uk. Today I've got the CEO, Mark Lawrence, and the CFO, Martin Walton, of Key Clark, ticker CTO, which is an electrical contractor. I'll ask the directors to tell us a bit more about the business in a moment. Disclaimers first, I hold shares in this company, which I've held for just under a year, and I regard it as a cool long-term shareholding of mine. I'm not charging a fee for this interview. Current share price is 87p, market cap of 36.2 million. And finally, I'm not giving any recommendations or financial advice. This audio cast is for general information only. Okay, so welcome, Mark and Martin. Should we start perhaps by asking you to give a description of the business for people who are not familiar with it?
Okay, it's Mark here. Interestingly, you described this as an electrical business, which is something we've been trying to shake off for a good many years. The business the business did start in 1889 as an electrical contracting business, so obviously at the very forefront of the electrical industry there. But over a period of time, we've evolved into what we class as a building services company. So we believe we're a nationwide building services contractor, delivering the full range of mechanical, electrical, and ICT. And by ICT, we mean communications, audio, visual, and the like there. And this is done from strong local teams across the country. We focus on our reputation. You know, most of our work is repeat client work, delivering good value, a total trustworthy business with excellent quality, because our quality is really one of the key things to our business. We operate from around about 14 locations across the UK. We don't desire to have a post box in every town and city, but very crucial for the majority of our clients is that they deal with local people who understand the local marketplace. We're committed to training, we're committed to a safe environment for our people, but more importantly, we set out to deliver a world-class building services company that is driven by its reputation. For me personally, I started with the business 30 years ago this month as an apprentice, worked my way up, so I understand the business from the very ground level to the position I assumed 5 years ago.
Right, okay, thanks for that. And apologies again about the misdescription there from me. So the key issue that's come through in sort of most of the readers' questions, and indeed the key issue for me really, is to talk about improving gross margins. I mean, historically, the business has been highly cyclical, and certainly during the few years after the financial crisis, most recently, very, very low margin as a percentage of turnover. Could you really give us some more depth on how you're going to increase the margins and how perhaps you can make the business less cyclical, or if that just isn't possible?
I think part of the issue, obviously, the core market in construction and working, unfortunately, does suffer from cyclical cycles. You know, in terms of that cycle, we are later into it, and obviously then that means we're later out of it. So when you see building contractors themselves sort of seeing a downturn, we're probably lag a year, 18 months after those. So our place in the cycle is slightly different. You know, can we focus in different areas? You know, what we do as a business want to stay true to what we do. So we focus on something as a pipe or a wire, something is true to building services. We focus on 9 business areas, and, you know, to capture again where you quote us as an electrical company. So we focus on 9 areas. M&E contracting is the core of it, but we also focus on areas such as transport, you know, that's rail and, you know, type projects, infrastructure projects, which we call mission critical, residential and hotels, design and build type building projects as well. All of those coming back to being a mechanical electrical contractor. What we've done during the recession, though, we have focused on some new areas. Rail in particular, you know, it's an area that we wasn't really heavily into. We've grown that during the recession. We've picked up 2 of the largest underground station projects undergoing at the network at the moment, which is Bank Station and Victoria Station. We're also pursuing airport work. You know, that's a business area for us that wasn't there 3 or 4 years ago. As we've come out of recession, that will add strength to the business. Equally, things like FM or facilities management, which is the afterlife care of the businesses. We're keen to explore further opportunities So more of our recurring revenues is from the FM type works. Margins will improve naturally as we work through the legacy, and that word haunts us a little bit, legacy, because during the recession we acquired jobs not at negative margins. We never sought to secure works at negative margins. Margins were keen, and margins were driven by the marketplace. And equally, we had to invest in keeping the business in some kind of shape, so when the good times return, that we had a business we can continue with. And I'll come back to the London market in particular, where that investment has paid off. Going forward, we will see the margins improve. I don't know if Martin wants to add to that.
I think the nature of our business, obviously, construction does, it is a long-term business. It takes a long time for bad news to work its way through, and it takes long, the margins do turn very slowly. We are definitely seeing the upturn now. I think if you speak to many of the main contractors, they've all had a sort of a number of bad jobs which have had to work their way through. That's put sort of pressure, right down the supply chain. But we are beginning to see the end of that now. What we're securing at the moment, we're going in with much firmer margins. And there's a sort of a much more positive outlook throughout the whole industry now.
Yeah, but that's interesting, because my last interview was with Nick Taylor, the CEO of Waterman Group. So I thought it'd be great to interview you guys next, because he's a lot earlier in the cycle than you are, in that they're sort of before buildings are actually built stage. They seem to be mainly involved, and I mean, he was really upbeat, really bullish. He saw the next few years as being very strong, which presumably means that you could have, I don't know, what, 3 to 5 year good years ahead of you. I mean, does that tie in with how you're seeing things?
Yeah, I mean, Nick, you're exactly right there with Nick. He's ahead of the game for us about sort of 6 to 8 months, because he's designing buildings. So his intelligence of what is coming through, probably spurs him on. I said a moment ago about London, we have been, very successful in acquiring the lion's share of projects that are available to us. And what I mean by that, there's some significant schemes in London that, are out to bid, secured via client relationships and, reputation, that we've done very well at.
Yeah.
Bishop's Gate, Principal Place, Rathbone Square, and the like, we've secured those. The larger schemes that we've not secured are ones where the principal contractor and the main builder has his own in-house capability, so they were never available to us. We've been very careful in terms of what projects we want to seek out. We don't, this may come across as slightly arrogant, we don't want to work with everyone, who calls himself a builder. We are very careful about our relationships, because we analyse the risk in the sense of what builder can actually build the building and return it. For us, the key skill for us is, once we're on site, is for the ability for our skilled workforce to do a productive day's work. So it's essential that we're working with like-minded builders who can work productively. And if we can work with like-minded builders, our productivity goes up, which means we get out of that job as quickly as possible. Work-performing jobs are for us, where jobs run late, you get in contractual issues, and, that no one wins in those scenarios. An efficiently run builder is what we look for to sort of team up with.
Well, I see. That's really interesting, actually. That leads us quite well into the first reader question, which is from Chris. And he's asked, could you talk us through your contract pricing process and risk control? He further comments, sometimes these guys need to decline work, which it sounds like you've just explained that you do. But he says here they often get sucked into marginal contracts loaded with risk. So perhaps you could cover those points?
In a broad sense, most of the work that we secure is on a tendered basis. We have our engineers, most of the engineers we employ have come up through the workplace environment as well, so they're familiar with the constraints of what we do on site. And, you need to bear in mind that every single building we do, we tend to reinvent the wheel, because an architect wants his building to be something special. So it's not like a factory in a widget environment. You know, every building needs to be studied. And to price a job, we typically get a series of drawings done by various consultants, Waterman's being an example that you mentioned earlier. And our guys have to interpret those drawings. They have to interpret the design and put a price to it. And in terms of pricing the database, you know, that's a fairly consistent process. There's a measurement to be done. The risk there is that if the guy mismeasures. In terms then, you know, there's various factors that need to be applied in terms of labour rate calculations, looking ahead to where labour rates will be. We enjoy good relationships with the industry association called the JRB that gives us visibility to labour rates over the next 2 or 3 year cycle. So we have good visibility in locking in our labour rates. And in terms of material risk, you know, what we don't try to do is to be clever and try to hedge our bets with copper and steel, which are, form a large proportion of our tenders. From submitting a tender, we will lock in our copper and steel for any projects that we secure. So it's de-risked immediately. So the key to, you know, the measurements of a drawing then, anything in terms of overheads, profit and margins, go higher up the chain of command within the business. And, you know, each project is looked at its own merit, but it was obviously looked at in the marketplace of what is sustainable at that time.
Yeah. I mean, do you have a central review process for tenders so that a particular, given you've got 16 branches, given that there's clearly a risk that one branch might start, you know, just mispricing and opening up a whole load of risk for the group as a whole. So do you have a review process for that?
The process is slightly more high-tech in the sense of all our businesses are linked up with a database that pulls off the best price for material, the best price for labour, and that's visible across the portfolio of our businesses. Where dialogue takes place, if a business, a local business, is doing something which we'd say is outside of its comfort zone, it is required to feed into the central business to take guidance on, one, whether it should actually bid that job, and two, if he is going to bid that job, how it should be priced and the approach there. So in terms of, you know, we employ local people who are good at what they do, and we have delegated responsibility for them to allow them to get on and do their day job. But anything out of the comfort zone comes back to the centre, and we discuss the risks and the ability to price that job.
Okay. So looking again a bit further at contract risk, because given that it's a relatively low margin business and very low margin in downturns, the overrun of, you know, you mentioned before saying the builders, you know, you can't get on site for some reason and there are lots of delays that incur extra costs for you. Do you have it factored into the contract so that you can charge for those sorts of losses that you suffer which are outside of your control?
In very simple terms, Paul, is if it's our fault, we have to pick up the bill, and that's why it's crucial for us to employ good quality engineers who know what they can do. If it's a third party's fault, then the contract allows us a recourse. That's not easily given out. You have to justify your entitlement, but the contracts do permit that if it's a third party failure, then that we have a recourse. And equally, if a client introduces a substantial amount of change, we have the ability to discuss and, you know, agree a revised program. So it's not all one way. Equally, you know, we deal with some very large scale projects, and the risk if we don't perform that those projects are not delivering the power and the water that they need to, you can understand why those contracts would be onerous.
Yeah, I see. Okay, let's move on to the next reader question then. We'll skip that one actually and come on to that at the end. Somebody calling themselves Blue Sky asks, how do you define and evaluate your UK market share? And what is your perceived market share and how has that changed over the last 10 years?
It's a difficult question to answer that. We do get asked, you know, what you try and pinpoint what is the value of UK construction, and then you drift off into different market sectors. You know, again, what we don't want to be is all things to all people. We focus on areas where we think we can add value to the business and in geographical areas where we think we can add value to the business. In the recession, the downturn, a little bit more of hunkering down and getting through the bad times. You know, in our core business of London, I think we are recognised as the go-to contractor in terms of building services. Our reputation, our teams of people, and the ability to deliver at the highest level, you know, people want us on their jobs. They're not always prepared to pay a premium, but they want us on their jobs. In the regions, we operate probably at a slightly smaller level, and there's more regional competitors. But I'd like to think that we're perceived, and in the market areas that we do work in, that we are perceived as one of the higher-rated companies.
Okay. And you're UK only at the moment, are you? Is that correct?
That's right. Yes, and I think sort of if you go back, long into the past, we have worked overseas, but certainly sort of the sort of in the recent past, we've been solely UK based.
I think part of the issue there, Paul, it goes back to the workforce. What slightly protects us here, in terms of our market share, is that electricians from overseas can't necessarily just come across to this country and work in our systems. Equally, we can't do that in their countries, and labour is predominantly cheaper, in other territories. Historically, as Martin said, we worked overseas. We're not opposed to looking at opportunities, but I think it's been challenging, working in projects in this country over the last few years. I think if the business was to look overseas, it would be in more of a partnership arrangement, so we understood the risks being explained to us before we went out there.
Yeah, well, I mean, as an investor, I'm pleased about that, because I think usually when UK companies, or often when UK companies expand overseas, it can end up opening up a can of worms, can't it? So that's reassuring, I think. You mentioned in one of your trading updates a little while ago about the labour market for your sector tightening up, and I think you kind of alluded to that a bit in the last answer when you were saying that there are barriers to entry and that you can't just bus in a load of Romanians to do electrical work because it's so complex and there are safety standards and qualifications needed and so on. So is that part of the mechanism that allows you to charge higher contract prices when the market tightens up? So is the market tightening up?
I think it's a combination of factors. When the recession hit, a lot of people exited the industry, and we won't get those people back. We took a decision to sort of retain our core directly employed workforce. It's obviously cost the business some investment during that process, but it does allow us to pitch to our clients to sort of reconfirm that we have the ability to deliver those jobs. In the London market, as you see now, a number of the schemes are all coming online at the same time, so there will be a huge demand for labour. And also the other infrastructure jobs like Crossrail are getting to the stage where the M&E services will be in demand. We see as a business and looking to future-proof the business, there are levels to where we want to grow to, but being mindful that an inevitable to a downturn will occur again. So we're saying to our clients, lock us in now, lock in our resource, and you can safeguard your project. And clients are open to doing that, and that's where we've seen success over the last few years.
Okay, that's interesting. Given that there are those sort of tightening competitive factors, if you like, which seem to be working in your favour, are you finding that you're under increasing pressure to pay higher wages?
What I said earlier about our skilled operatives, there's some visibility in terms of industry and union negotiations, so we see that the influence there coming through. I would say our competitors are slightly more of a disadvantage because a majority of our competitors subcontract out their workforce, and which means that workforce can become a lot more transient, and can cause them issues going forward. And if they've underpriced and underestimated that price, that can cause them problems. Our engineering workforce is in demand. We have seen some pressures on the increase of our engineering staff, but as we said in our announcement, we have invested in our engineering staff to sort of compensate for that. I think what we give our employees here at Clarks, I'm testament to that, is a career path. We can employ young people, 16, 17, 18-year-olds who can see a career ahead of them. And quite quickly, they can be involved in some of the most prestigious projects, in and around London and across the UK.
Okay, so is your staff retention quite good then?
Staff retention in terms of the apprenticeship model would be, 96-97%. And the ones we lose, there's a few people who realise the industry's not for them. There's a few people, once they get their certification, they want to go and explore the world and things like that. But a number of our young guys do the apprenticeship, and once they get to a certain point, there's four or five areas that they can move into the business, not just engineering, there's design, surveying, quantity surveying as well. So we offer a career path for people from a very early age that can lead to a lifelong career.
Okay, so looking at your employee base as a whole, what's the rough sort of level of staff turnover on an annual basis, would you say, ballpark?
I'll say our retention levels is into the 90s, 95%.
Right, okay. Very impressive. So that must bring savings as well then. So you presumably have to allocate relatively little time to recruiting and less to training once you've trained people up, I guess.
I mean, that's the key, Paul, and that's also what we're trying to reiterate, the unique selling point of investing in our direct workforce. You know, it's retained, from a site level as well. It's important that our guys work on sites that are safe and have good facilities. And that's what our people enjoy, and that's what we tend to promote, in that is paid back in the staff retention.
Okay. So in a way, it's quite an old-fashioned business model, but I personally think that's a good thing rather than a bad thing. So we're talking about cyclicality a lot here, but Nick Brock has asked the next question. This is quite interesting. He's asking, to what extent will Clarks be less cyclical in future, as the company seems to have moved up the value-added chain in the last 5 years? And also, with particularly ICT, it's becoming so much more complex now, isn't it? So will that affect things going forward?
There is a clear direction of travel that we want to, as we look towards the next downturn, that we enter the next downturn less reliant on, general contracting work. We want to build our repeat business work. We want to build our frameworks. The last acquisition we did in 2010 was a company that done a lot of FM, and we want to build upon that and build that model. So as we enter, not only the downturn, but as part of sort of making the business more robust going forward, that a lot of our reoccurring revenues are supplemented in that way.
Look, I'm going to sound really thick here, but can you just remind me what FM stands for? Oh, facilities management, I remembered. Sorry.
to crystallise FM, in a normal project, we would do the installation, we'd hand it over to the client, and then we'd walk away. FM builds upon the lifetime management of that installation. And there's reoccurring revenues to be had by a 2, 3, 4, 5 year framework or an agreement to maintain that facility. We tend to do the installation and walk away.
I think on the facilities management side as well, and we have been sort of slowly building that up in terms of sort of share of the business. But in a number of instances, that actually opens up further opportunities for you. Clients' sites, day in, day out, you're speaking to the client at a different level to what you are with sort of traditional contracting.
And
quite often, as projects are being sort of talked about, you get sort of the early intelligence on those, and sort of you're in sort of pole position often to secure those bigger projects as well coming off those sites.
Okay. And Nick also asks, does the company expect to achieve similar or higher margins than those achieved at the top of the last cycle in the mid-2000s?
And I think we are certainly sort of seeing the margins sort of begin to sort of tick up at the moment. I mean, I think it is still a very sort of competitive environment out there, and I think it will sort of take sort of some time for those sort of much better margins to come through. I think we can certainly sort of see a sort of gradual uplift in the margins over the next sort of year, 18 months or so, and sort of hopefully sort of pushing on towards those higher levels in due course.
I think each threshold at a time, we want to get over the next threshold, then move on to the next one.
I see. Okay. So you had a recent trading update, just checking my notes here, 20th of November, I think it was, so last week, wasn't it, saying that trading was in line with the board's expectations. Just a quick query, why do you not say in line with market expectations? And is there any difference between board's expectations and market expectations?
I don't think there's any difference. I think it's just a few people input into these statements, and some of the language used is guided by our brokers and other people, but I don't particularly see a difference.
Okay, great. And I see that a number of brokers have actually upgraded modest increases in their earnings forecast as well on the back of that statement, which is encouraging. Could we touch on net debt? I know you said that's dropped from 8.7 million down to 6 million between 30th of June and 31st of October this year. I mean, the balance sheet's not, well, it's a little bit on the weak side, I would say, mainly because of the pension deficit and the bank debt. I mean, are you planning to sort of allow retained earnings to build up the strength of the balance sheet during this cycle?
I think in terms of the dividend policy, obviously, you know, you wind back to the beginning of the recession. I think, you know, the dividend levels had got pretty high and we had to sort of cut those back, you know, a few years ago. I think we would want to be cautious in terms of letting that dividend build going forward. Yes, I think you are your observation is perfectly valid. I think, you know, we have utilised the realised reserve to some extent to maintain the dividend at a level, and we do need to rebuild that balance sheet strength a bit.
Yeah,
obviously the pension scheme, you know, we are also a victim of the marketplace there, and, you know, I think, you know, so we will begin to sort of see that deficit sort of come down a little bit as, you know, as the economy begins to recover and eventually interest rates begin to sort of drift upwards again.
Yes, because I noticed in the last accounts, I think the pension deficit's on the balance sheet at $15.7 million. The actuarial deficit can sometimes be bigger as well, can't it? I mean, what overpayments are you currently, if any, are you currently making into the pension fund?
Well, so, I mean, in terms of a sort of cash contribution, I mean, it's not a sort of huge drain. It's probably, I think, you know, the company is contributing sort of just under £1 million per annum at the moment towards the pension scheme, and yeah, a large chunk of that is aimed at reducing the deficit. Obviously, every time the actuaries get their calculators out, the deficit seems to go up at the moment, but you know, that will over time begin to correct itself.
Yeah, and is the scheme closed to new members now?
It is closed to new members, yes.
Yeah, okay, but presumably quite a few of the existing staff are still in the scheme, are they? Is that right?
Yeah, so it's not a sort of a huge scheme. I think there's probably about sort of 120 or so current staff members in that scheme, and it is only the staff that are in the scheme. It was always only aimed at the staff. The site operatives have their own industry based scheme.
Yeah,
which
I see.
Contribution scheme.
Okay, thanks. Moving on to the last question then. Who is it who asked this one? Oh, Ivan Campo, he calls himself. He's asked about director shareholdings. He notes that the director shareholdings seem very low. Could you expand on that and maybe mention the share option schemes as well?
There are some share option schemes in place, and obviously, you know, if the business do well, which we're driven to do, is, you know, those schemes play out. To be honest, Paul, this has been raised a few points, and, you know, you described this as an old-fashioned business, and I think that's where the roots of the business come from. Most of the directors have come up within the business. You know, if the time is right and financial things permit, you know, maybe the directors will buy more shares, but I think, you know, the directors themselves are more driven by, you know, getting the business, you know, back into increasing profitability.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the share option scheme, I think, is about 1.7 million shares, but they're priced not a million miles away. I was looking at your last announcement on 9th of October, I was pleased to see that the share options, you know, I think were only 10%, were issued at the strike price is only about 10% lower than the current share price. So personally, I don't have a problem with share options where you are incentivized to, you know, get the share price a lot higher, which you seem to be. What's the long term nature of the share option scheme, and when do they vest and so on?
Well, there's two elements to the option schemes we've got in place at the moment. There is an LTIP in place, which typically share awards or options are vest over a three-year period based on sort of earnings per share growth targets. And then there's the Save As You Earn scheme, which obviously, you know, a lot of employees invest in. I mean, think, you know, that was what you know, the announcement you referred to in October. I mean, there was a huge sort of take up on that scheme. I mean, all the directors took their maximum, you know, the maximum that we were allowed to in that scheme. But an awful lot of the employees also took the maximum. You know, it's been very popular, and I think it demonstrates the commitment of all our employees to the company and sort of driving this company forwards.
Okay. And I was going to say, with Mark in particular, having been with the company 30 years, I don't think really there's any question mark over, you know, in terms of your commitment to the company, for sure. Okay, we're probably out of time now, so maybe just some closing remarks. Any sort of final points that you want to touch on in terms of where you see things going or anything we've missed?
I think for us, driven by the London project, we think the business will look forward to, you know, a good few years ahead of us of growth. You know, if you walk around the streets of London at the moment, projects like Bloomberg, Rathbone Place in Oxford Street, Principal Place where Amazon are moving into, London Wall Place where Schroders are moving into, Deutsche Bank are moving to Canary Wharf. There's some, you know, projects we've already secured. And there's a number of high-profile projects that are opportunities to us. And I'm convinced we'll get more than our fair share of those projects, which will drive, you know, our growth and our returns over the next few years. So I suppose as a business, we're probably the most confident we've been for a good number of years.
Okay, excellent. Right, well, let's leave it there then, chaps, unless you've got any other final remarks.
No, we're happy with that, if you are.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks ever so much for your time. Really appreciate it. And hopefully we can maybe touch base in 6 months or a year's time.
Yep, good. Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Rashi. Thanks, gents.
Bye.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Bye.